Thank you very much. I cannot infect you, but I can certainly aggravate you for the next 12 minutes with this very bass and very gravelly voice, so I apologize on the front end. There are no relationships to disclose, and I'm going to be talking to you today by what might seem like a very obscure population to you, childhood cancer survivors, but I assure you there may be one or two among us in this room today, and their counts are certainly increasing as the cure rates for pediatric malignancies continue to enjoy such a wonderful success rate. What I want to focus on, however, is the modification of the bad effects that this treatment, the treatment that certainly has extended survival, but it carries with it some heavy burdens on into adult life. And I have identified several there for you, certainly not an exhaustive list, but things that are very important to our topic today, and that is obesity. This group is plagued by osteoporosis, cardiomyopathy, diabetes, hypertension, secondary neoplasms, and all of those chronic illnesses appear anywhere from 15 to 25 years earlier in this group than what you and I might face as non-childhood cancer survivors. And I pick these things because obesity is indeed a problem in this group. My colleagues about 5 years ago did a comparison using the health inventory survey of the general population. And found that indeed among childhood cancer survivors, the risk of obesity is increased over that of the general population. There are specific male and female risks among males, particularly Hispanic males. Among females, particularly Black females, there is an increased risk of obesity. Brain radiation in both groups, particularly if that exposure was to the hypothalamus or the pituitary. And then for our females, if their diagnosis of whatever their malignancy was before the age of 9, after the age of 5, and if they were exposed to alkylating agents, in particular anthracyclines, very commonly used in treatment of leukemia and Hodgkin's disease. There are other issues that we thought might play a role in survivors' obesity. Depression is increased in this adult group, and it seems to be tied to particular diagnoses. It doesn't seem to be across the group, but ALL and Hodgkin's disease seem to be particularly hard hit. And then those who've had a diagnosis of solid tumor, very often involving some disfigurement, some amputation, when they're compared to their sibling controls, certainly they had a higher relative risk of obesity. And I put this up just so you'll have some context. This slide has nothing to do with childhood cancer survivors. It's simply to remind you that many of the common antidepressants and antipsychotics that are so in prevalent use today in the general population carry with them the very nasty side effect of obesity or increasing weight gain. And while that might be an annoyance for you and me if we take these drugs, it is absolutely life-threatening for the childhood cancer survivor. So, my colleagues and I, largely epidemiologists, we said, let us put these new isolated facts together and see whether or not we can identify those things that increase the risk of obesity in our adult survivors. And then I'm very old, and I've been doing this kind of work for about 30 years, and always I am interested in understanding not just the direct predictors, but the indirect predictors, because this is what I like to target in terms of interventions. So I want to know the moderators and the mediators that might contribute to survivors being obese. And then finally, if we were successful in these identifications, where do we go from here in terms of intervention development? In terms of methods, source of data is the survey, which is part of the Childhood Cancer Survivor Study. It is the largest cancer survivor study in North America, has been around since the mid-90s. In order to be a member of this cohort, the individual had to have survived their pediatric malignancy at least 5 years after completion of treatment. They had to be diagnosed between 1970 and 86. And for my particular study that I report today, they had to respond to the baseline survey themselves, which means I only included those 18 years of age and older at baseline. And they had to have responded to the follow-up survey in 2002, 2003. Analytic approach, as you might imagine, since my other colleagues were epidemiologists, they went for multivariable modeling. Not my bag. Mine is structural equation modeling because I think it's a much stronger workhorse. I've been doing it since the late 70s. I told you I was old. And it's a much stronger technique in pointing to moderators and mediators. Now, to give you some idea about measures, obviously body mass index was our outcome measure. Anyone that had a BMI greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared was considered obese. Under that, you were not obese. Obviously, we adjusted for those who had had osteosarcoma and had various amputations, and the percentages by which we increased their weight given their surgical intervention are identified for you. There were demographic factors that, of course, were of great interest to me in particular for identifying moderators of obesity. Disease, treatment exposures, treatment sequelae, age at diagnosis, obviously brain radiation had to be in there, cancer-related pain, cancer-related anxiety, physical function as measured by the SF-36, physical activity, two variables. One was whether or not they met the guidelines, recommended guidelines for physical activity from the CDC, and the other one is, did they engage in active leisure time activity? And then finally, since the whole notion of depression had come up in recent papers, we were particularly interested in whether or not these individuals had been taking antidepressants or other prescribed drugs for their depression or mood disorders. Excuse me, we'll refuel here. Our sample looks very much like any childhood cancer survivor sample, and that is pretty equally divided between the genders. Largely a white population, less than half had graduated from college, right around 31 years of age when they completed the follow-up survey. Average age of diagnosis, about 8, and time since diagnosis, 24 years. So we're talking about people who are well beyond their cancer treatment. When we looked at my colleagues' multivariable analysis, not a whole lot of new information emerged here. Age 26 to 55 certainly increased your relative risk of being obese. That's consistent with the general population. Age at diagnosis popped up again, being 5 to 9 years. Keep in mind that the epi guys controlled for gender, so that was very, very easy to pop up. Again, cranial radiation, but we did have a new variable on the horizon, and that was the use of Paxil. The other antidepressants, antipsychotics, seemed to fall out of the multivariable model, but Paxil hung in there, and from relative risk would appear on that list to certainly be a heavy hitter. Decreasing your risk was having a college degree, meeting the CDC guidelines for physical activity, and having medium anxiety and fears about your future health. And I think our next speaker is going to be able to address some of that and continue this story. Now, I could put up all sorts of tables and numbers to talk to you about structural equation modeling, but we don't have time, and I'm afraid some of you would walk out, so I chose to do it this way, thinking we could have a little more fun with it. Keeping in mind what you found out through multivariable modeling, I'm going to walk you through this graphic. One of the nice things about structural equation modeling is it takes all of these variables and it says what role they're serving. And it also identifies the relative weight of that variable in contributing to your outcome, the strongest predictor of obesity in this sample. was physical function. The ability to walk upstairs. Can you walk a block? Can you walk several blocks? Can you carry a bag of heavy groceries up the stairs out of the SF-36? The second strongest predictor was not being afraid of your future health and worried about your cancer. So if you were laid back and you kind of said, I'm on cruise control, there were problems. The weakest predictor up here was the use of Paxil, excuse me. And that was about a 0.048 in terms of p-value. Now, important to point out that not only was cancer-related anxiety a huge variable in terms of being a direct predictor, but it also certainly fed into cancer-related pain, and then both of those, high levels of anxiety, high levels of pain, obviously predicted decreased physical function. Increased physical activity, decreased pain. And you might think the opposite should be true, that if people had lots of cancer-related pain, that would automatically be sort of a no-brainer assumption that they would be less physically active. That was true, but that's not where the strength of this relationship was. The strength was, if you're physically inactive, you're going to have greater cancer-related pain. New targets for intervention. Certainly we need to get the word out. I've already indicated that for you and me, not having had this childhood disease, we would be annoyed by taking a drug that contributed to weight gain, but it's a much bigger problem for childhood cancer survivors. It really is a near-death sentence because it exacerbates all of those things that I identified in the beginning of the presentation. And while I'd love to rush to physical activity as the very next choice for intervention, I won't do that because clearly physical function is much more important to this at-risk group. I don't think care providers, whoever they may be, are quick to think that a 22-year-old or a 32-year-old might have impaired physical function. And unless it's very obvious, they don't ask. They not only have endurance impairment, but we find that very often cardiomyopathy is beginning to make itself known in these young people very early on. Once physical function is restored, then it's time to talk about physical activity. And this meeting has had meetings and presenters all over in these last 3 and 4 days about physical activity, and I won't take time to do that, but there are very good intervention approaches out there. Finally, looking at the moderators and mediators of obesity, I didn't spend a lot of time on those gray boxes on the graphic, but all of those things are terribly important in terms of understanding who's at risk. We've already identified Hispanic males and black females. Perhaps extra attention at the end of treatment needs to be put toward demographic groups to make sure that families understand those risks. Low income, low education, again, what this meeting has been all about, that we need to make our providers a little bit more sensitive to the fact that if we want a good and successful, long-lived post-childhood cancer, we need to take some extra steps on that front end and throughout survivorship to keep these people informed. And then those of you that know my work over the last 20 plus years, sadly almost 30, you know that I am very much into affect and motivation and what we call cognitive appraisal, what people understand about their illness, what they understand that they can do about it, what they understand about risk, very, very powerful targets for intervention. On the academic side, in terms of implications for research, obviously, my colleagues want to push forward and do longitudinal studies. What was the BMI at the end of treatment? What was the BMI prior to starting some of the antidepressants and antipsychotic drugs? And yes, all that needs to be done. But I don't want to wait another 8, 9, 10 years before we've laid all that out, before we jump into developing interventions for this group. So I am set in certainly the next year, year and a half, to begin to. We've got a sample of 14,000 people that we can target in the Childhood Cancer Survivor Study and begin to get the knowledge out to them, begin to get information about their risks, and enable a successful survivorship. Thank you.